You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Oh, look, it's Derek Davison and Daniel Bessner, and I'm Robert Wright, and those three things together can mean only one thing. It's time for another High Synergy Crossover American Prestige Non-Zero Podcast featuring three of the world's leading authorities on podcast synergy on matters of war and peace. There's a lot of that this week that we're going to talk about. Also, it features one authority on AI in that trio. And, oh, shucks, I'm not even going to say who it is, but that will come in handy because you guys have some doubts about Anthropic's claim to have created a world-destroying AI. And I am going to give you pushback. I am going to give you, you should be very afraid. But first, there's so much going on with Iran that I should probably check in with you guys about that. You feeling pretty good about the Middle East?
Yeah, things are going great.
Fantastic, yeah. Mm-hmm. American hegemony in perpetuity.
Uber alles.
That's our motto over here at American Prestige. Primacy above all.
Yeah, so I don't know, a lot going on. I mean, as of now, you're getting reports of maybe ceasefire in Lebanon, maybe a peace deal with Iran and the U.S., although more recently it's been like, no, maybe some kind of agreement that makes possible an extension of the ceasefire. Meanwhile, you've got the blockade, of course, which I want to dig into because it's so unclear what's actually going on there and what Iran is likely to eventually do in response if some other kind of agreement isn't reached that would forestall that. So I don't know. Dive in wherever you want. Derek, you're a leading authority. You actually are. I mean, with all due respect to me and Danny, you actually know something about the Middle East. So, clarify things.
It's not about the Middle East. I don't know what Trump is doing from one minute to the next. Like, it's just, it's chaos. This week is, you know, it feels like the pattern is, if you dig into this enough, he's just trying to manipulate the markets, but it's like they start the week out with like, ooh, there's a new initiative. We're going to get a peace deal done. And then by the middle of the week, it's like talks are on the way. And by Friday, we'll be back to, you know, we're going to bomb them, you know, in 5 minutes, just in time for the markets to close. So I don't know. I mean, there was a moment yesterday where it seemed like they were really close to something. The chief of the Pakistani military, Asim Munir, went to Iran. Like Asim Munir is the most powerful man in Pakistan. He's you know, basically runs the country. So for him to get on a plane and go anywhere is a big deal. Went to Iran to push something. I don't know what it was, but it really seemed like they were cooking up something. The Pakistanis who are mediating this, or one of the mediators, seemed like they were cooking something up. There was talk of some kind of breakthrough on the nuclear front. The last thing I saw from, I think it was Al Jazeera, but this has been reported in other places, was that they're now talking about the length of a moratorium on uranium enrichment, which is quite a bit different from where things were months ago, where they were just talking about whether or not Iran should be allowed to enrich uranium or should be, you know, able to enrich uranium. Now they're talking about the length of a moratorium. That's different ground to be on. Potentially something, you know, a gap that could be bridged. Although I think they're both hung up on trying to beat the 2015 nuclear deal, which is just bizarre. But I think for both sides, that's a sticking point.
We should clarify, though, because you're right. First of all, this is a compromise on both sides. Iran was saying, we will not surrender enrichment for a moment, although, of course, we're willing to keep it at such a low level that you don't have to worry about any kind of near-term bomb. And the U.S.
I mean, the other thing to add to that is they can't enrich uranium right now. Like all of those facilities were destroyed or buried and would need to be reconstituted for them to do it. So like they could, there could be a moratorium, quote unquote, that's like really just, you know, they're rebuilding their centrifuges and their facilities But you know, if they portray it as a moratorium, you know, I mean, it could be something that works out. But yes, I mean, you're right. It's a compromise on their part too.
And it's not the only dimension. There was some confusion over this. There was a kind of misleading David Sanger piece in the New York Times about how,
David
Sanger misleading somebody
in the New York Times? On Iran's uranium enrichment?
Yeah, don't get me started. But the idea was kind of like, well, once again, a deal that won't last forever. Well, wait a second. I mean, it could still be the case that you have a 5 or 10 year moratorium on enrichment, and then it could be like eternally. Iran is committing to low-level enrichment plus monitoring and inspections. That would be, in effect, an extension of a kind of 15-year-ish deal that Obama did forever. So he was conflating apples and oranges.
We over here at American Prestige believe that the only way the United States will ever be truly safe is to destroy every other nation on Earth, which is the logic, apparently, of all the people who criticize any deal with Iran. It's that in 10 years, Iran could have a trillion drones. So how dare you? So literally the logic of all of this stuff is this all-encompassing security vision that says the only way the United States will be safe is if there is no other people on Earth. And I think it's important to actually call that out.
Wait.
Yeah. Preventative war.
Is it, or is that, which I think is more nearly the case, is that Israel's view about the Middle East
consistently degrade the capacity of all neighbors,
and doesn't America kind of get drawn into that one way or the other?
Well, I don't think in 50 years, China could have a gajillion drones. You know, like, I mean, this logic could be extended to anything.
You're right that hegemony is the unrealistic and stupid and counterproductive American model, but it's not it doesn't entail the comprehensive war making that I think Israel's national security.
Well, I think it does. I think
Israel doesn't have the tools that the U.S. has.
The larger point that I'm making, I just gave I did a seminar on this with my students the other day, is that like the American century is coming apart, and I think it's worthwhile looking at some of the fundamental assumptions of it. And one of the assumptions was that hegemony could be a different thing than the hegemonies or the more partial hegemonies of British and French empires past. But I think in practice, it's not. That's not possible. So as we sort of create a geostrategy for the 21st century, I think we really need to examine some of the progressive era assumptions about what American global hegemony was able to be. And I think these maximalist security visions were part and parcel of that hegemony. I mean, a book just came out called Total Defense. We interviewed the author, Andrew Preston, who's a great historian at UVA, and he shows how this all-encompassing vision really came to the fore in the 1930s is almost an outgrowth of the New Deal thinking. And I think going forward, we really need to challenge a lot of these assumptions. Because when you're saying, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, it'll never be enough for these critics. That's the entire point. It'll never be enough. The only thing that could be enough is if you literally destroy Iran or whatever country comes next. And I think it's worth interrogating that logic. And I think Israel does play a part.
Iran is not a threat to the U.S., and that's not the real reason.
Agreed, none of them are threats to the U.S.
I mean, it is not. Who really thinks Iran is a threat to the U.S.?
Why is the U.S. in the Middle East? Why do you think the U.S. is in the Middle East?
I think it has a lot to do with our relationship. It has a lot to do with our relationship to Israel. It has a certain amount to do with like reflexive holdovers from old thinking about oil, maybe. But you can't find many people in Washington, even in the think tanks, which I would say is not, you know, full of the people I would like to see by and large in charge of our foreign policy, you can't find many people who over coffee will say, God, I'm worried about this Iranian threat to American national security.
I agree, Bob. We agree. These are all, none of these places are security
threats.
You
can find people who say that about China, Danny. That's the distinction I'm making. You just shouldn't pretend the Iranian war is about American hegemony in a direct sense.
It is absolutely about American hegemony of control over the Middle East. We're basically now what we're doing out is figuring out spheres of influence.
I think it's much more about our relationship with Israel. And I think that's why Trump is in such trouble. The New York Times is saying this now and documenting it.
Why does America care about Israel? Take a step back. Why does America give a shit? Yes, domestic politics is a reason, but that's not why the U.S. is in the Middle East in the first place.
I think domestic politics is a powerful reason.
Why has the U.S. sought hegemony in the Middle East since the 30s over various administrations, some of which are critical of Israel, including Eisenhower, including Reagan, including George H.W. Bush? the Middle East is its own strategic objective. And absolutely, yeah. The Israel lobby matters. There's domestic political reasons why Trump was dog-walked by Netanyahu. I'm not saying there's not, but there's a larger issue for why the U.S. has been involved in the Middle East for over about a century at this point.
I mean, we come up with reasons. I just don't think anybody in Washington believes them. Iran.
I'm not sure I agree
Iran,
with that.
Iran, now, Iran is slowly becoming more of a threat to, I mean, you can't keep bombing people forever without them in some sense becoming a threat to your security, you know, but, and that's a kind of speech I'd like to give to Israel. Not that it would get much traction maybe, but this is not a long-term path to security for either country, I think, but, anyway, that aside, let me ask. I mean,
China factors into this too, though. I mean, China gets a decent percentage of its oil from Iran. They mm-hmm. sell things to Iran. They have a relationship with Iran, and so you can view it through that lens as taking out a Chinese.
But do you think that was
going
really
on?
It's not
really a client state, but.
Hey, we're talking about Donald Trump's brain, okay? Could we step back?
Of course,
and you're talking
not.
About like. More than one dimensional chess, I'm having trouble with this.
No, he thought it would be Delcy. I mean, this is right. Yeah, he thought it would be Delcy. That's
Trump,
why
of course he
did.
Trump is much simpler. If it's about what's going on in Trump's brain.
Yeah, he thought it would be 2 days.
He knocked off Maduro and everybody said, ooh, good boy, you did a good job. You're a good, strong man. And he wanted to do that again
somewhere.
That's
the only reason he did it.
Netanyahu sold him on this being a two-day operation.
Not only Netanyahu, Laura Loomer, and Mark Levin, whoever else.
Totally.
But,
all the luminaries.
That's what
all
I'm saying is, you know, Trump is just Trump. You know, he's just doing, he's just narcissism personified. And then various people try to sell him stories that will channel harness that narcissism to their ends. And this time, BB won. And
correct.
I just think
he's been trying for 20 years
to talk about this being part of the longstanding search for American hegemony by the U.S. foreign policy establishment. I mean, that's not irrelevant. Richard Haass, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, was the first person to raise this blockade idea. And he's like a geostrategic thinker. So I'm sure he can explain how this is in the service of American interests in his view. Can I ask Derek a question about the blockade? Like,
no, let's move on. Yes, of course.
What is, you probably have a clearer idea than anyone as to what's actually going on. It's not.
It's debatable.
Well, okay. So the way it's caricatured is, so he's going to oppose the blockade by doing a stronger blockade. Well, ostensibly, it's more subtle than that. What he's going to do is turn the tables is what he says. The old blockade let Iranian stuff through the port, but not other stuff. And he's saying, we're going to let other stuff through, but not Iranian stuff. I'd like to know, A, if that's working, and B, if we can tell, and B, Derek, whether you think if there isn't some deal, either an extension of the ceasefire along with some kind of understanding or an actual deal, which I don't think is going to happen in the near term. How long do you think it is before Iran starts creating trouble over this blockade? I would think not long. Right? And there's plenty of ways to do it. They just have, you know, drone attacks on the tankers from the other ports that are being let through.
Right.
And boom, you're done. Now the whole thing is blocked and Trump has to live with the global economic consequences, right? Seems easy.
Right. I don't get the sense that traffic is especially up in the Strait of Hormuz. So, I mean, the idea that ships leaving other ports are getting through because they feel like they're protected by the U.S. I think they're braving it because of the ceasefire, because they assume that the Iranians aren't going to just up and attack one of these ships. But it doesn't seem like many ships are attempting it or management companies or whoever. Are actually attempting it. I mean, there's been maybe a little bit of an uptick, but everything I've seen says is pretty consistent with how things have been proceeding during the war. Like, there hasn't been a huge uptick in the last few days. That could change. I don't, you know, we'll see. We're still in the fairly early days of this. There have been a couple of instances where ships that are headed to Iran or coming from Iran seem to have gotten through, or seem to have at least gotten through the strait. even though CENTCOM, you know, insists it's turning ships back and, you know, there's been zero activity from any Iranian ports. I think part of the, not that I would ever consider the U.S. government or the U.S. military 100% reliable source on anything, but like they're just doing lies and memes now. Like it's in a very basic way. Like that's all that this administration is capable of doing. So it's hard to parse what's real and what's not. Like shipping data is I think more reliable than like tracking information is more reliable than anything that CENTCOM says. But some ships are turning off their tracking systems either to avoid the Iranians or maybe to try to avoid the US. So even that's not hugely reliable. It feels like kind of a black box to me right now.
Yeah. Do you agree that if they don't pull some kind of rabbit out of a hat that either extends the ceasefire or comes up with a true deal, Iran can't put up with this for too long before escalating along roughly the same dimension?
No, I don't think they can sustain indefinitely. It's I don't know if it's the inability to export oil or the fact that they're going to run out of storage capacity at some point. Like I don't know when that's going to be. I've seen wildly conflicting reports about how much oil storage capacity they have. But once that runs out, then you have to start shutting down oil fields and facilities, which is a long process to get them back. To get them going again, and you know maybe you don't get them back to full capacity once you do, and it's you know it becomes a really big headache. The longest I've seen was a report in Reuters that said they have about 2 months of capacity, storage capacity. Mm-hmm. So like that could be a point at which, and I've seen other reports that suggest they have less than that. So that could be something that they're worried about. The loss of revenue is significant, but they've been eating, you know, loss of revenue from the U.S. for, you know, over sanctions for a very long time. They've shown a pretty resilient. They've shown themselves to be pretty resilient in the face of economic pain. So, you know, who knows? I don't know what they'll do. I don't think they'll start, you know, I don't think they want to be the first party to start shooting again, like to just start, you know, up and unilaterally attacking like the Gulf ports or whatever. So they may try to intensify their blockade,
even like or non-lethal attacks, one drone strike on a tanker.
Yeah, I mean, they could maybe try that or try to interdict or something. But yeah, I don't know from the Iranian perspective if they want to be like if they want to start be the ones to start the shooting again.
I would think long-term control of the strait is important enough to them, barring some comprehensive deal that obviates the need for that in terms of,
right,
you know, having enough future leverage to forestall attacks from the U.S. and Israel. I would think that if they don't get something like that, some deal like that, then maintaining control is so critical just as a means of ongoing leverage. And by the way, from our point of view, not a bad form of leverage because it's ultimately like nonviolent. If it's just a toll booth and they can say, hey, we're stopping traffic, that beats the hell out of them saying we're gonna barrage Israel with ballistic missiles in the event that Israel attacks us. But whatever. It's a form of leverage important enough to them.
Well, and it's cheaper. I mean, if oil was $60 a barrel, but Iran was charging, you know, $1 million a barrel to get out of, or, you know, a dollar a barrel or whatever it is, like, a, you know, 2 million per tanker.
That's $1 a barrel.
To get out of the Gulf. Like,
that's not much.
That's a lot cheaper than oil at $120 a barrel.
Right. No, it's a pretty easy
calculation.
Andrew Day had a piece in the American Conservative about this, about how it's not a bad outcome for there to be a toll gate necessarily. But in any event, I would think if I'm Iran, I don't want American control of the strait to kind of solidify, right? Like eventually you want to get back to that. The other downside of not doing something, I mean, on the one hand, it seems like Iran isn't in a bad place. because the global economy continues to pay the price, and that's bad for
Trump.
This
is great for Iran overall. I mean, this is one of the ironies of this. This was one of the best things that could have possibly happened to Iran, which is to turn something that was theory into practice and basically demonstrated itself as a gigantic regional power in a way that no one presumed. And in fact, I think Derek beforehand assumed the opposite.
You mean by this, you mean the blockade or the original assertion of control over the Strait?
Yeah. The blockade.
Like their assertion of control over the Strait. Like
the Strait of Hormuz it was a gigantic... I mean, to be honest, I think that's why China's interested in Iran. Because I think Iran demonstrated itself as a worthy power in a way that no one assumed beforehand. Not only that, after a lot of their leadership cadre was destroyed. So not only is this likely to be, I think, over time, an American strategic loss, it's kind of an American humiliation once again. Ironically, because one of the only reasons I think Trump cares about Iran is because of 7980. And so now he just caused another American humiliation for people who care about such things. I think that's actually quite a big deal. And will become clearer in time.
Yeah, no, it's a huge
I think in terms of like the long-term outlook, I don't know if the Iranians are worried about the U.S. establishing control of the Strait of Hormuz.
Like, no, they're not.
This is a huge expense for the U.S. to maintain.
We can't do it.
This kind of naval presence there. And the Iranians can just do it from shore. Like, it's very easy for them. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult and costly for the United States. Unless, you know, you get... all the losers and haters in NATO to join in and police the Strait for you, which they might do if they're not going to get shot at. But if they feel like they're going to get shot at, then they're not going to jump in to that.
And they are going to get shot at. So they're absolutely not going to do that, particularly as they're moving away from the United States. And I think they're going to start pouring more resources into Ukraine. Because I think that, I mean, Derek, I don't know what you think. I'm actually pretty... have a good sense of what you think. I think the U.S. support for Ukraine is going to continue to dwindle. I don't think there's going to be a huge resurgence, regardless of what happens in the midterms or in 2028, if the war is still going on. And I think Europe's going to start shifting itself to that. It's not going to have the capacity, which is going to divert money from its own social welfare programs. So it's not going to have the literal capacity to do the policing action that Trump imagines. This is just, from any way you slice it, a short, medium, and long-term loss for American power. Now, I still think the United States is going to affirm the Middle East as its sphere, as part of its sphere of influence. I think that's probably, from the American perspective, the thing that is going to happen as a result of this, as we sort of enter a new form of multipolarity, kind of a great power multipolarity, different from the concert of Europe. We can get into that if you want. But I think overall, Iran has really asserted itself in a way that no one expected.
Yeah,
Ukraine's interesting because I think the Ukrainians are making an interesting...
Yeah, agreed.
To try and replace the United States as a source of arms for Europe.
Israel. Israel.
They started with the counter-drone stuff, and they've got these deals now with several Gulf states that are going to theoretically bring a lot of money into Ukraine to develop counter-drone technology, but also to develop just generally the defense industrial base. And I think for the Ukrainian perspective, they can go to Germany and France and the UK and say, like, look, you can't rely on the US anymore. You're not going to be, maybe that extends even to buying US weaponry. But look, we've got all this, all this capacity now that we've built up over the course of this war, not just to fight, not just to build weapons, but to build weapons that actually work in modern combat, that have been tested in modern combat, as opposed to, a billion-dollar drone that you're going to lose 16 of over the Persian Gulf, or another massive boondoggle of an aircraft carrier or a fighter jet that doesn't work. Like, this is stuff that actually is meaningful and that's been tested in battle that we can sell to you, and they're gonna boost their stature. Yeah,
they're going to become the last Wellian garrison state, the frontline state. It makes absolute, like Sweden was, Sweden was a weapons innovator because it was on the frontiers. And it makes sense that Ukraine is going to do that. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah. And the drones are a story in themselves. I mean, just the technology, because I think Danny's right that the U.S. model of global hegemony was kind of doomed to increasingly not work out anyway. But these drones are maybe rendering, the particular form of military hardware that we're so good at obsolete faster than would otherwise have been the case. I mean, the Russians encountered some of this too with Ukraine. And I'm not going to say that drones inherently favor defense necessarily. But, you know, because in Russia, you see the balance kind of swing back and forth, depending on who made the latest technological move and developed some kind of countermeasure.
Yeah, the offense-defense balance. Yeah, it goes back and forth.
But it does change the game. And you do wonder, you know, well, there have long been questions about aircraft carriers. You know, the handwriting's kind of been on the wall. But you do wonder if what we're seeing is something that should give America pause, not just in asserting force in the Middle East, but in Asia. Because I think China's ahead of us on drones.
Dude, China, it's not a matter of if, but when. This is why DC is so annoying. It's not a matter of if, but when with China. And the fact that they're not devoting all of their East Asian resources to basically doing a security transition with allies is like the height of foolishness. It was obvious 5 years ago, and it's even more obvious now. It's just like the magical thinking in Washington, D.C. about maintaining hegemony in East Asia. It's absolutely fucking ridiculous. It's just so mind-annoying, mind-boggling that this is just not the medium-term strategy. You're obviously not going to be able to confront China in East Asia. What are you talking about? You can't confront Iran. It's absolutely ridiculous.
First of all, I'm happy to give them more reasons to doubt the wisdom of confronting China because I didn't think that was a great idea anyway. If you're talking about militarily,
agreed.
But yeah, no, it's a crazy, and we're seeing this. I mean, we literally have had to withdraw stuff from, you know, South Korea's defense and so on for this thing that still has no coherent rationale in terms of America's actual national security. And by the way, I don't doubt that among the stories being told to Trump in the attempt to harness his narcissism to the end of bombing Iran, what were stories about American hegemony and China and so on. Everyone in his vicinity is trying to tell him a story that will get them to do whatever they want to do for their reason. And there are a few people probably you could find somewhere in the establishment who think that attacking Iran made sense from the point of view of China. Those narratives were round, you know, but I
think it's because of Delcy. I think Netanyahu gave him a fake plan.
Oh no, at
plan.
That level, it's clear. Yeah. He thought it was Venezuela all over again.
Yeah.
At the level of Trump psychology, yeah. I mean, it's so scary that we're only not even a third of the way through this.
Do you think, this is the big question to me, something I've been arguing for fucking 15 years now, is like the presidency needs to be totally transformed. Like it is a crazy office. Mm-hmm. The power that office has is absolutely insane and nothing about what the founders imagined or what basically anyone until FDR really imagined. But you never hear anyone talking about it. If Trump isn't going to make them rethink the entire office, and I don't know what is.
Well, for
it's
starters,
so fucked.
I mean, just to get back to the domestic stuff.
They're not,
you know,
though. I mean, they're not rethinking it. They're still debating like
it's
FISA
insane.
Renewals. And like, let's just renew it. Let's give Trump a clean renewal of FISA. Because, you know, I guess he won't be there forever. I don't know. I don't know what the logic is. Like, why would you hand that kind of power to a madman?
One quick thought. I just finished listening to a biography of John Adams. And, you know, one thing we note that's become apparent with Trump is that if there's an emergency, a declared emergency, then the president suddenly has a shitload of power, A, and B. So who decides if there's an emergency? The president. That's kind of a bad system, okay? There should be some check on that. And back in olden times, when they wrote the Constitution, it wasn't practical to have Congress have to vote on whether there's an emergency, because if the people in Congress were back home, it was going to take weeks to even get the news to some of them that they should come to Washington. You know, now we can do that instantaneously. There should be some minimal level of congressional authorization. You can decide what it should be, but an emergency that is going to give the president nearly dictatorial powers should not be something that can be declared by the president unilaterally, right?
Nobody in Congress wants that.
Yeah, and a couple of quick things about that.
No one takes responsibility for it.
Yeah, and a couple of quick things.
It's so abstract. I don't think that's quite the problem. I think the problem is the partisan one that right now that would seem anti-Trump and the Republicans would go against it. And then next time it would seem anti-Democrat. democratic, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, the founders erred because they were much more worried about revolutionary parliamentaries because they were building off the experience of the Glorious Revolution. So they weren't as worried about the executive, which was obviously a wrong choice. And I would argue we've been governing in an emergency framework. I just published a book with Cambridge about this called Cold War Liberalism, which goes through this entire emergency politics thing. And I would say the U.S. has been basically governing through emergency since 1917, particularly with the new anti-immigration acts and the sedition acts that Woodrow Wilson passed, and then the New Deal with the 3,700 or so executive orders. The American state was basically built through emergency politics. As you know, Congress hasn't declared war since 1942. Emergency and American hegemony go together. And we're never going to have an anti-emergency politics until American hegemony goes away. It always starts in foreign affairs, and then it just basically colonizes the entire rest of the system. And we effectively don't live in a substantial democracy at this point. We live in, at best, a procedural democracy, and Trump is even threatening that. So there are like fundamental problems to this entire structure that no one ever talks about, and we're just going to get, if not literal Trumps himself, but more of these types of actors into the system, unless the system itself is reformed. And as you both well know, the United States is unique in still operating according to an 18th century constitution. Most other North Atlantic countries have had, the various French republics, for example, they update their constitution. So I think this is a big deal that no one is really considering. And these problems are just going to recur, eternal recurrence, unless we actually address them.
That's a good Nietzschean reference there, Danny, that some people didn't get, right? Eternal recurrence, isn't that him?
Yeah, it's a common thing in 19th century philosophy, I think. But I'm not a philosopher. I'm just a philosopher king. I'm not a philosopher.
That's what we need, is philosopher king. One more question about Iran. I know you wanted to talk about AI, which I'm always happy to do, but America is, I mean, in terms of like whether right now Iran can kind of live with this for a long time because the status quo, because, hey, the global economy, price of oil is still high. That puts more pressure on Trump. And although it's weird. The futures market the oil futures market seems optimistic as of today. That was back down to the low 90s, well above pre-war levels, but still the actual price being paid for oil in the real markets where it's changing hands is well above that. So for reasons I don't understand, there is optimism out there. But meanwhile, I would think that the one thing that might worry about Iran about status quo is Trump is sending even more force, right? Even more military force toward the Middle East. Isn't there a whole new carrier group or something? And I guess one scenario is it's just a threat to get them to do the deal Trump wants. Another is maybe somebody has revived his hopes in actually winning the war. And then the third possibility is he's going to declare victory and go home. But first, he wants one more several days of onslaught. But in any event, I would think the downside for Iran is that America and Israel getting to reload, much as Iran is, on the other hand. Iran is taking care of a lot of business, getting a lot of missiles ready, and so on. But I'm wondering if you guys think there is going to be, or likely to be, another major Israeli-American military assault on Iran.
It's possible to know. I mean, maybe.
Derek
yeah.
knows. Over a Derek long knows. Enough horizon, I think, yes. Like if they don't.
Yeah, I told you, Danny. Derek.
Like this, there's no settlement. Like, I haven't understood this all along, really, but like, there's no guarantee that Iran can trust from the U.S. There's right. no. Guarantee, like the U.S. and Israel have shown themselves incapable of coexisting indefinitely in a world with this Iranian government. So I think until regime change, and not that I think that's necessarily going to happen, but like I don't know that they have any capacity to settle for anything less than regime change, meaning the U.S. and Israel. So I think It's inevitable now that the line has been crossed. I mean, this was a line that U.S. administrations for 40 years wouldn't cross because they knew it would be a really bad idea. now that we've found a president who's dumb enough to cross it, I think maybe, yeah, it's sort of baked in at this point. And you know, the president who's willing to countenance Israel crossing it. Like there's, I guess that's the other shoe that could drop, which is that the U.S. finally elects a president who doesn't just write a blank check to the Israeli government, you know, on January 20th at the start of his term and say, whatever you do, we'll back you to the hilt. And then that constrains Israel. But, you know, how likely is that to happen anytime soon? That's another long-term project.
The one hope, first of all, I agree. People don't pay enough attention to the fact that Iran is never going to trust a piece of paper signed by America and Israel. Why would they? The two most manifestly
That is anti-Semitic. How dare you?
Is Trump Jewish? I didn't know that. I would trust Netanyahu's signature before I'd trust Trump's signature. But that's true. And I think that's one reason it's so important to Iran that people understand that they can take control of the strait when they want with a few drone strikes that terrify insurance companies. But the one path I can see that could avoid conflict is if they do an actual nuclear deal, whatever they say on enrichment, the key thing is that it has that feature that the Obama deal had, which is such intrusive monitoring and inspections that we know that we would have months and months of notice if they did a breakout to do a bomb. I think in the future, with everyone having seen the price the world is paying for Trump having gotten out of the deal we had, I think, first of all, if Trump does this deal, he's not going to withdraw from it. And I like to think we're not going to have another president who's stupid enough to withdraw from it. And so long as that's the case, you're not going to have an American president who will sign off on Israel attacking Iran. Now, Israel could still attack Iran, but if you had an American president who said, and okay, this is maybe a wild thought experiment, but if you had an American president who said, you know, we just can't afford a bunch of missile interceptors this time around, so you're on your own defensively if you want to attack Iran, then Israel wouldn't attack Iran, I think. So that's the way I can imagine lasting peace.
I agree. Like the logic of the 2015 nuclear deal still holds up. Like you can do something on the nuclear issue that involves inspections and limits. And yeah, I mean, the limits sunset in that agreement, which is part of the reason why we're here. It's part of the reason why they're talking about this moratorium having to last 20 years, because Trump wants to be able to say his deal is longer than Obama's deal. But the idea was, like, by the time all those things sunset, we will have built up all this goodwill from, you know, kind of sanctions relief and working together. And maybe we'll be talking about other things that are, you know, of importance in the region. And, you know, it could fundamentally change the relationship. That logic holds up. Where I think this is an impossibility is I just don't think that this administration is capable of negotiating that kind of deal, because they don't want to. They don't want to put in... Like, that's a painstaking process. It involves technical talks. It involves months of work, ironing out every little detail on a very granular level. And, you know, their negotiating team is J.D. Vance and two, like, head real estate guys. Like, they don't want to do that kind of work. They're not interested in it. If the best outcome I could see from all of this is that you get some kind of, as you alluded to earlier, you get some kind of like overarching agreement in principle that lets everybody say, oh, look, we did it. We can, you know, extend the ceasefire now, and then we'll get to the details when we get to them. And then they never get to the details because Trump and Witkoff and Kushner and like, they don't care. They don't want to. It's boring. It's you know, lame ass nerd shit. They don't want to get into that. And so they just declare victory and leave. And the ceasefire is sort of, you know, indefinitely renewed, or, you know, keeps being renewed every 2 weeks or 6 months or whatever it is, whatever they decide on. And you just stay in limbo for the rest of that time. I just don't think that this group is capable of doing serious diplomacy and negotiating a serious agreement.
No, I think that's a problem. You know, the counterpart to this High Synergy crossover podcast is, occasionally I do on with the American conservative Kurt Mills and Andrew Day. And at the beginning of the Trump administration, I was doing one, and they were expressing hope in an Iran deal at that point, and there was talk of it. And I'm pretty sure what I said was, you know, I just don't think they have the competence. I just don't think the administration has the competence to do anything this complicated. And I'm afraid I think you're probably right, Derek. I mean, they've got a little more firepower in terms of expertise that they're devoting to this, maybe. But Jesus, I mean, they've gutted the administration in that regard, first of all, probably. And yeah, it's bad. So AI. Now, we should probably go into overtime soon, but we can at least set up this conversation, which I'm happy to do because I have a book coming out in June called The God Test, Artificial Intelligence and Our Coming Cosmic Reckoning. One thing I'm wondering is, do you guys have a view on whether viewers and listeners should or shouldn't pre-order books written by podcast hosts?
pre-order away. Yeah, well, the New York Times bestseller list is rigged, right? But I'm sure, Bob, your thing is with a top five. So it'll actually be looked at. I know friend of the pod, Matt Chrisman's book sold an incredible number of copies, more than enough to make the bestsellers list. And he was not on the bestsellers list. So it's all fake. It's all rigged. Do what
was
you
the
want.
Book? We should get people to order that one. What was the book?
No Pasaran. Matt Chrisman's Spanish Civil War.
Did they do another printing of it? I don't know if it's...
I think they did. I don't know exact numbers, but I know it's sold.
Words? That's three words, N-O...
No,
that's one word. Two words. Yeah. No is a word, and Pasaran is a word.
It's about the Spanish Civil War.
Oh, no one will pass, or they won't pass? Yeah.
Don't pass.
Before we go to overtime, I should say that as we've been talking, Trump has announced that there's a 10-day ceasefire in Lebanon. So I don't know if you want to talk about that after the break, but we can talk about that
a little after the break. If it's true, it'd be great. I mean, ceasefires involving Israel don't have a history of, you know,
you cease, we fire.
Unblemished compliance, I would say. But that'll be good. There's generally a reduction
before overtime, did you see that awful, what's the congresswoman from the CIA? What's her name? Is it Stefanik from Michigan?
Slotkin.
She did like this horrible post, like justifying not giving offensive aid to Israel. Is this going to be fun to watch all of these jesters try to figure out how to deal with the new Democratic Party in 2028?
She did cave.
But it was like this. It was like this tortured explanation. You know, it was like Yale Debating Society explanation
for why she did it. In her suffering?
Well, it's going to be great when all these people run for 2028 and they don't know what to do. Yeah. I'm getting my popcorn ready for that because it's been a gigantic shift and it's been a mega quick shift and they do not know how to respond to it.
And, you know, I don't know how it'll play out in the general either, but it's becoming pretty clear that in the nomination process, you know, intra-party, probably a bad idea to say, let's send all the arms that Israel asked for. So to set up the AI thing, you know, Anthropic, of course, released, I assume most people have actually heard of this, but maybe not. They didn't release. They said, we have this model called Mythos.
It was too good.
I have bad news for you. I think they're right and it's very powerful. But
you have to sell books, bro.
No, I mean, this is important.
I'm just kidding.
Listen, this is serious. The left has to fucking wake up on AI. And I'm not kidding.
Because the policy is in the hands of
Silicon Valley libertarians, and they're going to fuck us up. And if the left keeps saying, oh, this is all hype, it's not a dangerous technology. I mean, or they say it's dangerous because, you know, it'll affect, you know, the market for low-income loans or whatever, or lead to more ethnic profiling. Those things are bad, but no, it's a lot more dangerous than that.
I think it's going to deindustrialize the white-collar working class, whether it works or not. That is coming. And also, I just think the policy is going to remain in the hands of the Silicon Valley billionaires.
As long as long as you guys say this is not worth anything other than joking about,
no,
yeah.
We could say whatever we want. It doesn't matter. That's the truth of our era.
That's a different argument.
Well, I mean, there's two levels to this, right? Like, well, okay, what we're but talking wait, about
we
is
should go, we should let's okay, go into let's officially go into overtime.
Everyone's quickly,
sorry, I lost my head for a second.
Quickly, yeah. What happened is the model they didn't release because they say it's too dangerous. They say it is capable of finding exploits in every major operating system and browser and often figuring out a way to exploit the exploits, you know, finding vulnerabilities and exploit them. And so they didn't release it. Instead, they made it available to the companies that maintain the infrastructure, you know, like Microsoft, Cisco, Google, so that they can find holes and patch them. And then they'll figure out when they think they can release it safely. That's a story. Is part of it marketing hype? Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, but this is what I'm saying.
Like, okay, now, wait. People okay. can access overtime, where we're headed, by becoming paid subscribers to either the Non-Zero Podcast or the American Prestige Podcast. Separately, by the way, to put in one of my frequent plugs for your excellent newsletter, Foreign Exchanges, Derek, a paid subscriber to either Foreign Exchanges or Non-Zero can get a 50% discount on the other. And I know if you're a Non-Zero paid subscriber, the way to find that is just go to our homepage. It's like a
part of the Non-Zero network.
Part of the Non-Zero network. Okay. Now we're going into overtime. Thanks, folks.